during the break that since people have questions about these next two, that instead of following the strict order of the notes, that we just jump in and that way we can probably cover the things, because you've all done the readings, and so that would be a way to do. Now, Jeff has a question that goes back to the first paper, so we'll start with that, and then Jorge, and then if the rest of you have anything that you want to bring up, we'll just do it that way. And then if I think there's anything that hasn't been covered that should be, I can take it up at the beginning next week. So, Jeff?
Well, what happens when one group accuses another group of inauthenticity? I mean, my fear with Lonergan is always that you wind up in a coherence view of truth, not a correspondence theory. In other words, if enough people in the community get together and agree, have a consensus, then they make a judgment of fact or value. That's a grasp of the real. But what about the other group that disagrees and is charging them of inauthenticity? There was a point in history where everybody believed that the earth didn't move. They had all made that judgment of fact based on the evidence they had, which was, well, look at the moon. It's there, it's there, it's there. You know, or sorry, the sun. Look, you know, and the phases of the moon. Mm-hmm. Explanatory developments allowed for mm-hmm. a grasp of the real, but mm-hmm. so sorry, I'm pushing it too far. Mm-hmm. What happens how does Lonergan avoid falling into a coherence view of truth?
A coherence view of truth is idealist and relativist.
I like the failure of the machine, I must say.
Is it
gives
working?
You a chance
there
you
go. It's working. So, okay, so you've got, there are basically three distinct positions on truth that need to be distinguished from one another. There's the coherence theory of truth, and there's the consensus theory of truth, and then there's the adequatio, the adequation of the mind and the reality. Now, so the coherence theory of truth, you'll find this in someone today, the very respectable and responsible theologian, Wolfhart Pannenberg. If you look at what he says about truth, I quote this in some articles, and possibly in what is, I think it's in What is Systematic Theology, the quote. But that truth for him is the coherence of conceptualizations. Well, that's an idealist notion of truth. Okay, so the greater coherence that you've got, that's what you can hope for truth. But you can have a coherent conceptual system, and it might have nothing to do with what is. Okay? So, the consensus theory of truth, a very sophisticated representative of that in the contemporary scene would be Jürgen Habermas. And Habermas does not have a way of adjudicating, I don't think, finally, truth in the sense of that truth is the correspondence between the conceptualizations that we've come up with and what is. So, and again, with Habermas, it's a wonderful encouragement to a community to open dialogue and so on. But there is no guarantee that even very intelligent people reaching consensus are going to be right simply because they've reached consensus. There is another standard that is to be. Now, the problem with the correspondence theory of truth is that we don't reach it very often in complex issues. We reach it quite often in ordinary everyday living. So he gives that simple example of the man who left his house in the morning and everything was neat and orderly, and he came home and there was smoke in the air and the windows were smashed, and he said something happened. Well, that's a true judgment, and nobody's going to deny that that's a true judgment. Okay, so it's true because the judgment corresponds with what is. That's what gives it truth. Now, that is Lonergan's theory of truth, but at the same time, he says that in the more complex matters, we do not reach it very often. So that science itself does not claim to be anything more than the best available scientific opinion of the day. All right, by people who have intelligently and reasonably and responsibly done their homework. This is what they've arrived at. But they have to be ready that it could be falsified. And even the very structure of scientific verification is one that will not provide anything more than hypothesis. The structure of scientific verification is if A, then B. So A is your hypothesis. So you test the hypothesis by saying, if A, then these consequences, B. You set up your experiment and you find B. Does that prove A? No, it just doesn't disprove it. It just says, well, then possibly A. If B didn't work, A would be thrown out. The hypothesis would be false. But when B works, it just means that A is one possible explanation for it. It doesn't do anything more than that. Okay, now, so Lonergan's not advocating either a coherence theory of truth or a consensus theory of truth. He isn't. And he's saying that, and his dynamics of judgment are the dynamics that, first of all, he learned from John Henry Newman in The Grammar of Assent, and then applied in many different fields in the chapter on reflective understanding and insight, where he takes up judgments in science, judgments in mathematics, judgments in common sense, and then in method and theology, more than in insight, judgments in history and interpretation, hermeneutics. But even with interpretation, he will say a lot of the time you cannot come any closer than saying this is the best interpretation that's been reached to this date as to what this author intended to say, if that's what you're after in terms of interpretation. And for Lonergan, that is the ideal of interpretation, is to get to what the author wanted to communicate. So, but he is holding out, and it's at the same time, the correspondence theory of truth for him is not just an eschatological ideal that we're going to reach only with the beatific vision, because we do cumulatively reach true judgments. But it's always a task, and being is a task for Lonergan, because being is reached through true judgments and in no other way. We don't reach it by taking a look, we don't reach it by understanding and conceptualization, we reach it only when we make a true judgment, because then we say what is. But that is, and in many areas, is a very complex matter.
Wouldn't you say, Bob, that Lonergan really integrates critically what is intended in all those various theories of truth?
Would I say that?
Do you agree with that? If I say that's what strikes me, it seems like, because I think he preserves the truth of coherence, mm-hmm, and the truth of consensus. For instance, like in belief,
I think
he brings that up.
Yeah.
And I think when he speaks of explanatory understanding and so on, I think he preserves that as an important component. But he gives me an ability to hold all of them together in a way that's...
That's what I would say, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that statement, because I think it's true. And that's why when you see him talking about empiricists and idealists, while he's not an idealist, he's much more sympathetic to idealists than he is to empiricists, because they recognize the complexity of the process of moving to truth. And that their world is mediated by meaning, and they know that it is. But he's not. He himself is not an idealist. Obviously, he isn't. But this is what critical realism is. So. I think what Raleigh said is right. I don't know if that helped at all.
It is helpful. I'll just very quickly say my concern here is that, for example, in the present-day context, you have a great number of Catholic youth who will articulate that, for example, premarital relations are authentic. The Church condemns them. Now, I recognize the Church as an authority, and I make a judgment of value that what they're giving me is correct. But this group will say to me, no, you're being inauthentic, we're being authentic. In other words, we're, you know, if I'm in a loving relationship and I want to express myself in this way and so on, that's authenticity. So don't you dare tell me I'm inauthentic. And I'll say, yeah, but wait a minute, we've got church authority and you make a judgment of value, of trust. So what do you make recourse to when you've got a debate between two groups, both claiming authenticity, namely Catholics who take the church stance on premarital relations and Catholics who don't take that stance? What do you make recourse to if the subject is the what it all boils down to?
Then you make recourse to, have you raised all the further relevant questions? And that's it, you know. You have nothing else to make recourse to. Because even your, I mean, let's face it, I mean, even your acceptance or my acceptance of the church's position on any given issue is my acceptance of it, you know. And ultimately, I'm responsible for that judgment and that assent. And it's my assent to it. That's all I would say on that. And I don't want to take, I'm not going to take a stance on any particular issue, because there are some issues that I feel more strongly on than others. Quite frankly, there are some where I'm in complete agreement with the teaching authority of the church on moral issues, and others where I say that there are further questions that have to be raised. But I don't want to get into that, because I'm not a professor of moral theology, so I don't want to get into the details on these things. But that's what you. What else can you fall back on? You know.
And I think with youth, like I have a son who's 25, and he is living with his girlfriend. They're going to get married. But that's, you know, I didn't preach to him the doctrines of the church. I asked him questions. I said, "Here's some questions that I'd like to put out to you, that for me represent a call to authenticity in relationships." So that's all. I offered him some questions in case he hadn't addressed them. Not to answer to me, but to ask himself and to ask about his relationship.
If it turns out that the church is right, though, and mortal sins persist, there is a bit of a danger here, in the sense that if we give subjects the freedom to be authentic or inauthentic, and they do make an informed judgment of value, they say, no, I'm confident that I'm going to pursue, for example, premarital relations because I'm in love and so on, they give reasons, and they say, okay, I'm not going to be a power without authority, and you let them proceed. It could be that they're persisting in mortal sin. So there is a sense in which, by relinquishing power, you can wind up letting an individual be in a state of persisting mortal sin. That's what worries me. So a part of me wants to hang on to the church as power without authority.
I guess
if you accept Lonergan, you have to accept the whole package. You can't really.
Yeah. And see, yeah. I mean, I guess I'd have to say, where are you getting your definition of what constitutes mortal sin? To, you know, I mean, is it something out there, or isn't it? You know, and in how many instances can we say that something? I mean, there certainly are some acts that simply are objectively evil. Taking an innocent life, we would all agree on that, okay, without any question. But, you know, where do you go with some of these other issues? I'm not going to take a stand on the issues that you're raising. But, you know, to be honest with you, I have dealings with a lot of people whose sexual practice does not conform to the strict teaching of the church. And with the people that I know, if I if my judgment is that they're being responsible in their relationships with each other, I'm not worried about it. I have to say that. That doesn't worry me. Because that's where the rubber hits the road, as it were. You know, it's not in terms of a legal set of prescriptions. And I think that, I mean, I'll go out on a limb here, but with the limited and perhaps extremely limited authority that I have in this area, because it's not the area in which I do my work, but I do think that a lot of rethinking is required in terms of the sexual ethics of the church. And I think that the church would do very well to say very little about it for the next 20 years. Very little, except the things that you know, because I think we have a lot of reworking to do. That's my it's all being recorded.
And the context, you know, like the situation that my son is in, that those particular circumstances, my mom, when she was living, was saying, well, in my day, we did this and we did that, you know, but this is a different context. Grew up in a single-parent home, got different issues that he's dealing with that I didn't and my mom didn't, and you know, I have to trust that, and I do trust that he's a good guy, and that he's struggling to make the best decision. I know he is for himself and this woman.
You know, in my own kind of concrete experience in trying to deal with, let's say, two conflicting groups that have conflicting views of what is right and what is wrong. So what do you do? One of the things that has been really helpful for me is that to engage authenticity in a dialogue. I think that's one of the things that Mulligan is trying to bring out in this, I think. When you speak of the subject, the authentic subject, is, in some sense, the authentic subject is always in a community. So it's always within the context of a dialogue, I think. So my own response, if I base my response on what Mulligan is saying, I would say I would have to cultivate some form of authenticity in dialogue that ropes me in. That ropes me in as an authentic subject. So in that sense, I would say what I would need is to be, in terms of the formal structure of the authentic subject, I need to cultivate that and hope that I'll be able to cultivate that in the person that I'm engaging in dialogue with. So being attentive, try to understand as much as possible, being aware of the values that we have, making judgments and so on. But in as far as the material content of the issues are concerned, that is something that unfolds, the authenticity of that, I think, unfolds in the dialogue for me. So I have a certain relation to that material content, but I'm always part of the formal authenticity, I think, is that I remain open to what my horizon is blind to. So I prefer engaging in a dialogue and hope that the other person is also open to my own horizon. And just in that dialogue, just, okay, let's pay attention to the data. What's there, you know? What is the value that you are apprehending? What is the value in what I'm apprehending, you know? Why does that... Okay, do you agree that the value I'm apprehending is a value? I agree that what you see is a value, so why is there a conflict? Should there be a conflict? Or those kind of things. So for me, it's in the context of a dialogue that I think... So it's not an isolated subject of some sort.
No,
I don't see Lollingen as saying that.
No.
So I think the community, the dialogical context is extremely important, even for me as an individual to grow authentically, I think. So that's
okay.
The way I would kind of
Thanks.
That's operate cool. with, I think. That's how I would operate. So.
Okay, Jorge, you had some questions with respect to both method, trend, and variations and the Aquinas paper. So I think this is the best way we'll get into the things that are concerning you who have read them. So you want to...
Okay, I'll go for the one...
Go for the big one.
The big one? I'll do it after the first one. The first one is a simple question. In the chapter, method, trend, and variations... Lonergan seems to be explaining the inner trend of knowledge and centers it in method. The development in knowledge occurs within a horizon of the individual and community, but ultimately the objectivity and impartiality rest in the authenticity of the scholar. So knowledge ultimately has to do with... So my question is, what does knowledge ultimately has to do with insight or being in a community or with following a method or with being authentic? Or the combination of all that. And that goes with another question.
Is this the big one?
No. That the big one is another one. With the social, the school of Frankfurt, they make a theory of society.
Critical
theory of society. Habermas says, knowledge depends on the society. Therefore, we have to think a theory of society to be able to think that knowledge is possible. The liberation of society is the possibility or the condition for knowledge to really emanate or to come forth. So my question is, what do we do about all this? I mean, because in insight, when I study insight, it looks like the most important thing is to have that insight. The insight is fundamental, even though it has two moments, insight of understanding and reflective insight, right? And then in method, it looks like it's the subject. And here, it looks like it's a community thing. So I'm just asking because I want to link a lot of things. And the last one, I was thinking about innovation and creativity in other terms, maybe in psychological terms, but here I think innovation, it has to do with differentiation. Is innovation differentiation? Because that's a whole different outlook of what I thought innovation, change, creativity was. It's a whole new thing. I mean, it's about the source of meaning. It's about creating meaning. It's about another thing.
Okay. And that final one is your...
That's the big one for me.
Big question. Okay. Now, the knowledge thing. All right. What he's talking about here is, in this article, is the emergence of method the trend... Okay, and what he does say is that he's been talking more about the trend than about the variations. I'm trying to get a hold of your question, because it's not so much knowledge, but how does the grasp of method begin, develop, and take command in anyone in any field? So it can be, he's written about method, and he's written a generalized position on method, which he says, you know, is applicable to many different fields. And in this paper, he's concerned with articulating at least some of the dynamics of how that inner trend toward being methodical in your field begins, develops, takes control. So it's not so much just knowledge. So he's not going back on anything that he said in insight with respect to the importance of insight at the level of direct insight and at the level of reflective insight giving rise to judgment. But rather, all of that now comes to play a role in the development of a methodical mentality, which is not simply something that is just in the individual, but is in the community. So you begin to learn to be methodical in a community, because you begin to learn to be methodical when you apprentice yourself to a mentor who is methodical. This is now, he's talking here about whatever field you're in, whether it's music or theology, you begin to learn to be methodical by listening to the people who are methodical in the way they go about things. And you learn the tools of the trade from the people who have mastered them. So that's how it starts. It starts in a community. You start by doing what others have done, or by following the ideals that others have done, and or what others would advise you to do, or what others demand that you do. If it's a professor saying you've got to do this for this course, well, you got to do it whether you want to or not. And you know, some professors don't know what they're talking about, but a lot of them do, you know. So you have to, the methodical mentality grows in a community situation. It's not something that one learns on one's own. You learn it in a field of collaboration. And you discover, the dynamic is, you discover how important it is when you've made a discovery as a result of being methodical. Then you learn how important it is to be methodical. And you've got it in your repertoire, you've got it you know what it is to have made one significant development in a field, okay? And, you know, if you're in a professional field and if in the course of your life you have made one lasting contribution to that field, congratulations, you know. One original contribution to a field. I mean, how many people do more than that in any field, in science, you know, or in mathematics, or in philosophy, or theology, you know. So, but if you've done that, or you've made a discovery that is acknowledged by the community as being, this is new, this is big, or this is good, or this is helpful, then you know how meaningful it is to have appropriated the tools of method in your field. Okay? So that's the kind of thing that he's talking about here. And then he's talking about it in terms of philosophy and theology when he says that logic becomes subordinate to this process of raising and answering questions, which is what method is all about. Logic has a place in there, but it's subordinate to caught up in a much wider process. Now, how important that would be to the musician or the artist, but there's something analogous in music and other forms of art to what he's talking about. They might not call it method, but they would call it the practice, whatever the practice is. And there is a way in which people apprentice themselves to someone else before they go out on their own. Bill McNichols, who did the icon that we have in here, apprenticed himself for 7 years to a master in iconography. You know, and that's how he learned to do it. Well, what he learned there was the equivalent in iconography of what Lonergan's talking about as method. And, you know, and then he sees how important it is when he creates his first really original work of art and says this is very good, you know. So that's the kind of thing that this paper's about. So he's not going back on insight, mm-hmm. and judgment and so on, but he's talking about the importance of belonging to a community that already has some tools of a trade, and that's how you get started. Now you may influence the tools of the trade as you go along. If your discovery is something that changes the face of the discipline, then you are no longer, you're now in a position where others are going to apprentice themselves to you, you know, because you've shifted something. Einstein shifted something, and he showed that people were asking the wrong questions. Or whatever. Now, and if any development in any field has reached that point, then there's a shift. Because there's been a contribution made to method, there's been an inverse insight in the language of the book Insight, that changes the field. And it changes not just the content, it changes the procedure, the method. If all of a sudden it just becomes clear, those questions that this community has been pursuing for the last 50 years are not ever going to lead anywhere. Then the method itself has been developed at that point. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that's with respect to the knowledge thing. And the knowledge resides in the community. But the science, for instance, resides in the community. The science of theology resides in the community of contemporary theologians. It is not in any individual's head. What's in my head, I may have the best take of anybody that I know right now on the four-point hypothesis in chapter 6 of Dale, because I've been thinking about it for 5 years and I don't think anybody else has. But there's a whole field of 8 functional specialties that make up this discipline. And the discipline in its present state resides in the community of people who are doing those 8 functional specialties. And I'm just one little iota in that thing. I might have something to offer to that community, but I don't have the whole package, anything but that. So in that sense, the science is a community enterprise. It resides in the community. There may have been a time when the whole of geometry resided in the mind of Euclid. It did. But that ain't our situation any longer. It just isn't. The whole of geometry probably doesn't reside in any one mind. And maybe it does, I don't know. But certainly not the whole of theology, the whole of physics. Lonergan says there are physicists who know how to run a cyclotron, but they don't know which experiments are important and which ones aren't. And they've got to go to the other, the theoretical physicist who probably doesn't know how to turn a cyclotron on, to get what they should be exploring. Otherwise, they come up with a lot of data, but they're not important. Okay, now your big question on innovation. Have I answered the other one? Have I responded to it at all?
I should go through the article again, because I read it only once, and I read it carefully, but it looks like I
it isn't an easy article. It's one of these things where he's into this more removed frame of mind. Although you found it very helpful for Greg's doing a lot of thought now on what goes into musical creativity, and you found it helpful for that. But it would be good to read it, because what he's talking about is not so much knowledge. Mm-hmm. Knowledge is experiencing, understanding, and judging, okay? But rather the trend to method in a scientific or philosophic or theological or whatever community, okay? Apprenticing yourself to someone who really knows the tools, and then when you know that you've made a discovery, then you're ready to go out on your own. But until then, but you're in a community context, so there is that communitarian context to it. Okay, the innovation.
The innovation is innovation differentiation.
Well, it depends on where you're talking about innovation. Okay, he's talking about innovation in theology here. He's talking about Aquinas as both a repository of the tradition, which he certainly was, and Aquinas did a masterful, for his time, scriptural commentaries on a number of the books of the Bible. He read the Fathers, and he's constantly quoting Augustine, Dionysius, John Damascene, and so on. So he's appropriated a tradition that has come down to him. Not too much of the Greek tradition, the Greek Fathers, I don't think. But he's also a great innovator, and the great innovation is that he needed a conceptual system in order to address the issues of his own time. And he found that conceptual system in Aristotle. And so he put together the tradition that he had, that was residing very much in his own appropriation of the scriptures and the fathers, church with a conceptual system that was culturally very predominant in his day, and he created a new theology, created something new by bringing those things together. So in that sense, he was an innovator. And Lonergan's saying that contemporary theology must do something analogous. It's not Aristotle so much as it is contemporary science, contemporary hermeneutics, scholarship, contemporary, and the development of a philosophy that can be at home in contemporary science and scholarship, like Lonergan's philosophy or whatever, that we need as the equivalent to what Aristotle was for Aquinas, and our own appropriation of the tradition. So we must be traditionalists and innovators in the same sense in which Aquinas was in his time. The appropriation of the tradition, but we have many more tools to do that because we have hermeneutical and philosophical methods that Aquinas didn't have, and historical methods that Aquinas didn't have. But we also have scientific body of knowledge that is far beyond what Aquinas was able to find in Aristotle. So innovation, if he's talking about innovation in theology, and innovation in theology is a matter of differentiation and integration of developments, differentiation and integration both, I think. Now, innovation in other areas, it's having an idea and trying it out. So, you can be a great innovator in a parish, you're the pastor of a parish. Well, you don't necessarily have to go through yet another differentiation to be an innovator in the parish. You and your parish team can have a wonderful new idea, and you try it out and you find that it works. That's innovation. But he's not talking about innovation in that sense. He's talking about innovation in theology. So Aquinas was both a repository of tradition and an innovator.
See, what I discover is that he really compared, like, to the common language we use in Latin America about innovation. It's very, very concrete. And I think Lonergan in this article is talking about innovation at the level of the creation of meaning.
That's right.
Which is, has to do with methods.
That's right.
And
that's right.
That it's about it's that about a very talking. Abstract thing that has to do with culture, which is meanings and values. I mean, the root of society, the root of everything.
Yeah. Now, see, I don't know that I would call that abstract.
Okay, but it's
because you come up with a new meaning, and you do come up with a new meaning if you have an original insight. But that's not abstract. You know, it could be quite concrete. What Aquinas did was there was a movement that started before him that was leading towards the trend towards system in theology, and Aquinas, there was a coincidental manifold of movements towards a systematic viewpoint in theology that reached its first secure plateau in the two summas of Aquinas, in the Summa Contradictionis and the Summa Theologiae, at the first secure systematic plateau in theology, in the history of Catholic theology. Systematic presentation. So in that sense, he was an innovator. And every field, at some point, Lonergan says, moves towards the need for system. Okay. And Aquinas was the one who felt that need in his time, found Aristotle as the one to help him do it, and presented a theological system. It wasn't a rigid system, it wasn't a closed system. Aquinas never... this point Lonergan makes in many points. You read him on page such and such or question such and such, and he'll say, there are two meanings to the word axio. action, and then he'll talk about each of them in the context of the question that he's dealing with. 50 pages later, there are three meanings to the word oxio. Okay? He's not contradicting what he said earlier, but he's throwing in another meaning and talking about those three. And so it's not a system in the sense of that all the terms are rigidly defined at the very beginning and so on. He's defining them as he goes along and meets new problems. So he finds that his two meanings of oxio don't fit this question, so he comes up with a third meaning of it. But it's still a, is systematic in the sense of giving a coherent explanation of the faith. A coherent and comprehensive explanation. I mean, he covered just about everything in theological questions of it for his own time.
I've got a charade. I've got lots. If you're looking for them, I've got them.
Go for it. So,
okay. In the Aquinas Today article, Lonergan says, "As horizons change, there is a shift in what is known, what is of interest, and what merits investigation." My question is really simple. I'm interested in how we change horizon. I mean, is it as simple as taking our scientific cap off and putting our religious cap on? How does one shift the horizon to change what merits investigation?
That's not a simple
question. I mean, is it as simple as changing hats?
Yeah. It's a very complex question because the shift of horizon, horizon can shift through the accumulation of new data that you weren't aware of before. It can shift through the emergence of a higher viewpoint in a field, but it can also shift through a conversion. But the emergence of a higher viewpoint is not necessarily a conversion. Okay? It's just a rearranging and a more embracing, more all-inclusive framework for what you've already been dealing with. But all of those things are changes of horizon. Joseph de Finance spoke of the vertical shifts of horizon, and Lonergan correlates those with conversions, I think. I want a little time to reflect on your question, but I think that horizons can expand and contract without one going necessarily through a conversion or a breakdown of one's integrity. Not so much. I'm not sure they can contract without going through some kind of a breakdown in integrity. I mean, once you've got a more inclusive horizon, why shift back to that? The less inclusive one. But your horizon can shift just by, I mean, you can go to listen to a good lecture in a field where you're already well informed, but there can be such a new and original take on the material that your horizon shifts. But I wouldn't say that that's a change of heart or that it's a conversion. It's just that, oh my gosh, you know. But you haven't, you know, you're not repudiating your past and turning around and doing an about face in the sense in which conversion, he is using the term conversion. So horizons, I think the change of horizons can be. But, you know, like, for instance, the thing about what merits investigation, it may have been the point that. It may have been that before I heard such and such a lecturer talk about something, I thought that this particular aspect of theology was not worth pursuing at all. But I got a whole new take on it. So now I'm interested in what people are doing in that field. I wasn't interested in it before. That's a it's a change in horizon, because horizon is the limit of not only what I know, but also what I'm interested in.
Thanks.
I think that
crisis works. Anomalies.
Hmm?
How about crisis or anomalies?
Anomalies, yeah, definitely, definitely. Much, probably much more dramatically. Mm-hmm. Crises and anomalies will force a shift. It is 4 o'clock. I don't think we should, but. It was this satisfactory to just deal with the questions that people had rather than going through. And if you've got more questions on these, I intended in my notes, but you can do it simply by looking at the notes on Aquinas today. I start out by going back to the paper that we didn't cover last week, The Scope of Renewal, and sum that up in number 16, because in that paper, The Sum of Renewal, The Scope of Renewal, Lonergan himself was dealing with the seeming demise of Thomism, and he's also dealing with the same issue here, so the two can be read together. I remember him talking about how difficult it was for him to write the paper, Aquinas Today, Condition and Innovation. He said he labored over that paper for an entire summer. Mm-hmm. So, and this was a guy who had spent 11 years doing nothing but studying Aquinas in his earlier career, but to address the issue that they wanted him to speak to. They had a symposium at University of Chicago on the medieval heritage of Bonaventure and Aquinas. And Karl Rahner and Lonergan both spoke on Aquinas at that meeting. And I think it may have been, no, it wasn't the first time that they met, but it was the first time that other people had seen them together, Rahner and Lonergan, and they were wondering, what language are they going to speak? They spoke Latin. To one another.
Wow.
Rahner didn't, and I don't, Lonergan could read German, but I don't know whether he could speak it, and Rahner could not. When he lectured in North America, he would read the first paragraph, and then he would sit down and somebody else would read the rest of the lecture. And then the question and answer sessions, they would translate. So the question would come. And there was only one time when the translation was not necessary. Well, there was one time. I don't know if it was the only time. This was a story that was told at the CTSA a couple of years ago. And that was when Rahner was talking with the bishops in North America, and one bishop said, well, wouldn't it just simply be easier if people would just let the bishop say what they want to say? Nein! So he understood the meaning of the question, and he responded right away without translating. And he responded in German. In German, no! It wouldn't. That's not the answer. So. Okay.